The book we're discussing this week is nonfiction, chronicling the author's experience at English football games over the span of 8 years. American writer Bill Buford's gonzo-tinged book, Among the Thugs, is a violent, abhorrent narrative of masculinity gone wrong. Or perhaps masculinity going as masculinity ought to go. Greetings, Attic Wives, and welcome to Fuckboys of Literature. I'm your host, Emily Edwards. A content warning in the show, not just for the notes. When I say that Among the Thugs is violent, I mean it. It includes nuanced descriptions of mass and acute violence, which we do not discuss in perfect detail in the audio, but in case you are planning on reading the book, I want you to be prepared. Most of it is male on male, but the book also includes a detailed description of a sexual assault on a mentally challenged woman. The violence is bloody. The violence is often put in terms of colonialism and class warfare and fascism and racism and, in a word, incredibly, incredibly British. It's for this reason, the real-world manifestation of the promise of British literature and of the colonizer Western canon, that it's a book we're discussing on Fuckboys of Lit. All right, everyone. With me today is a voice you will recognize from two incredibly popular past episodes, our episodes on Franny and Zoe and also Les Miserables, which was a trip. We've got a lot more interesting conversation for you today with Jonathan Aid. How the hell y'all? How the hell are you?
I am. I'm doing okay. I'm doing okay. Thank you for having me again. I love having conversations with you regardless. I love having conversations with you about some of my favorite things that I've read and get to reread. So, you know, no, have you done an episode with nonfiction?
Vaguely before. So, obviously, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas is not nonfiction, but it is very heavily based on Hunter S. Thompson. And so I've done a little bit of dabbling in gonzo and a little bit of nonfiction before. But not to this extent.
Yeah.
In this way.
Yeah. I was like, I just, you know, I think when I suggested some books to you, I was like, you know, I think with other titles, I was like, okay, there's definitely a fuckboy in there. Mm-hmm. You know, we can talk about, like, I've got like a fuckboy in mind, you know? Yeah. And in this one, I was rereading it, you know, this weekend. And I'm like, oh, well, I wouldn't say any of these people are fuckboys in that. Well, I just think of fuckboys as like, you know,
as the romantic sense.
Yeah, like a characterization in relation to, you know, female predation. You know what I mean?
Or there is a bit of that in here, but not as much.
Yeah, yes, there is. There is definitely. I mean, that's not the predation that I was.
No.
Thinking of. But like, yeah, the, you know,
the just classic this, Marius sense of.
Yes, exactly right. You know, this, and also just being kind of like a fuckboy, being kind of like, a kind of like new-ish psychological classification. Mm-hmm. Whereas this is like, this book is like as old as the earth, like aggressive ape kind of. Kind of behavior, you know, like this is like, this is primal in the worst way.
In a disturbing way.
An incredibly disturbing way, you know, and so I was like reading it and I was like, I wonder if this counts. It's certainly a kind of, you know, it's certainly a kind of chauvinism that's dangerous.
Yeah.
So it has that parallel, but, you know, I was like, ooh, I don't know if this works for your thing.
I think it counts. Especially because there is a very, even though the subjects of this book are literally 30 years old, you know, the football riots that he's discussing are about as old as we are. It's a very interesting look at masculinity in a way that we like to dissect a lot on this show of generally speaking, I try to keep things a little bit erring on like the not crime aspects of things, of just like, you know, tenuous or strange or inappropriate interhuman relationships. But more right. often than not, they do sort of cavalcade or cascade into violence as well. And it is incredibly relatable, familiar to anybody who's watched the news in the last 5 years.
Yeah, sure.
Of this incredibly, like you said, primal, violent nature of human gatherings, and especially white human gatherings, which we mm-hmm. I don't think we can extricate whiteness from our discussion on this particular book.
No, I don't think we can.
In a way that is just deflatingly, abjectly, depressingly familiar to anybody, where you think this sort of violence has been left in the past. You hope, as I remember seeing some of these like news stories, especially of like the huge catastrophic one that they talk about at the end. I remember seeing news stories about people dying in soccer riots or things like that as a kid. And I really had suspected that it was gone by the wayside. And no, it just takes different right. locations.
Well, you're referring to that the crush of humans and
the crush. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. And I mean, you know, well, just recently the
Astroworld concert,
the Astroworld festival kind of came to mind. I mean, that wasn't, you know, well, neither actually that event in, you know, 1989, 1990,
correct. Yeah.
Or this event, could be considered a riot.
Right. It's more of a panic than a riot.
Yeah. It's exactly. But it is related to group human behavior and mm-hmm. sort of failures of design in some ways to account for the amount of people where, you know, it's related in that, like, you know, individual decisions stop being
right
relevant, and yeah. crowd psychology starts to really take over, you know.
Yeah. Okay, so before we get too much in further sure. into this,
yeah,
I have to ask you a very pointed question, because I've known you for a very long time. How did someone like you, who is a very gentle, loving person, pick up this book? Because it is yeah. violent and terrifying.
It is. So in 2000, when we first came to LA around 2007 or 2008, there was a collection of nonfiction stories that Ira Glass put together, mm-hmm. that he curated. I think it was called The New Kings of Nonfiction.
Gotcha. I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah, and so it had, you know, a selection of nonfiction pieces, and I was like, you know, I was 23 or something, and I was yeah. like, I like Ira Glass, and you know, I'll see what these selections are all about, and a selection from Among the Thugs is one of those things.
Gotcha.
And I was immediately struck by the writing, and particularly because I think that the section that he excerpted was from that first trip to Italy.
Oh, okay.
Where he was describing how he kind of became a part of that, the journalist Bill Buford became a part of the crowd, and how, you know, he just like, I described in like these vivid details about how his kind of individual instincts and sense of himself kind of gave way to this kind of group mentality, and how it happened, and mm-hmm. the physical sensation of doing so. Not to mention that, like, you know, he's a very funny writer in many
ways.
He is, and like
yeah.
The way he describes the hooligans, you know, is in many ways very funny, you know, I'm not sure if to say if it's not neutral by any
no.
means, you know. He like lets his prejudices fly.
Oh,
you
yeah
know?
Yeah, the class shaming, the fat shaming, the body
oh, yeah.
shaming, just the intellectual shaming that happens is endless in this book. Of
it
he is.
Is
very much an American, but American who has been accepted probably by the higher intellectual classes of Britain.
Oh yeah,
just
right.
fully degrading the working class, you know, like air quotes slobs that he finds himself against. But it is affectionate in the way that he's like, look at the way these men entertain me. And he's just like, it is so somewhat like, it's almost like he's on safari, you know, where he's get to be amongst these people and they perform for my pleasure. You know, this sort of like Roman emperor kind of like, I get to sit back and watch this unfold around me.
Right.
But he's,
that's not condescending or anything, is it?
No. But then as the book unfolds, which is something that was very uncomfortable for me, he actively, joyously becomes part of it.
Yeah, he does.
In a way that I was really not expecting from the way that he was describing these lower class, working class British men in the funeral selection that you're talking about in the very beginning, where he's just like, I find this abhorrent. Let me, you know, like be amongst the unwashed masses. And then at the end, he's like, let's fuck things up. And it's like, yeah. Oh my God, how did you get there?
Right, right. It's fascinating. And I think, you know, I think, honestly, I feel like that the honesty of his own, like there's just parts of the book where he's like, it's like, I was bored at this point. I didn't want to be there anymore. I was like, okay, let's let this riot happen so I can get home, you know, like that. That's the kind of level of honesty that like it feels somewhat redemptive to me.
At least,
you know, it makes me not hate the writer. Do you know what I mean? Because like if he was entirely judgmental and never didn't dive in himself, you know, I'd be like, well, what do you know about it really, you know?
Yeah.
But he got hurt.
Yeah, he got hurt real bad.
He got hurt a few times. Yeah.
And feared for his life amongst the British fascist class, and he really dabbled in a lot of seedy British underbelly for this. And definitely could have been killed at several occasions.
He could have very well been killed. I mean, he was in the war zone, you know. You know, there were many things flew by his head, and at the very end of the book, he does get savagely beaten by the Italian police on Sardinia, right?
Yeah, on Sardinia.
That's the last chapter. It's interesting. It's a funny little bookend, actually. The Italian, two different Italian cities.
Yeah. It's a very interesting way of looking at Italy in a way that I was not expecting. Italy gets such a weird sort of bastard child of Europe, because they're always kind of portrayed as like dumb and poor by the Brits, the French usually, and sometimes the Germans.
And the Northern Italians.
And the Northern Italians. You know, anybody who's close to Switzerland.
All of the sort of historically poor areas of Italy are all in southern Italy, right?
Correct. Yeah.
And then northern Italy looks down on them, and southern Italians sneer back up at them, you know?
Yeah. It's very fascinating that, I guess Turin is in northern Italy, when that's where the first sort of riot.
Yeah. It's like northwest. It's close to the French border, I think.
Yeah. And so the perspectives that he takes on, he's very complimentary towards the Dutch, and he's very complimentary, you know, there is very sort of like peppered through classist ways of describing all the various people of Europe and the various people involved in these sorts of skirmishes. It reminded me so much of the January 6th riots, the way that he was describing this influx of white angry men, almost exclusively men. Women very rarely make appearances.
There's no women in this at all.
Yeah.
And that was another thing that I was like, oh boy, this is just so vicious and masculine, this whole book.
Yeah.
I think also one of the reasons that like it appealed to me is the wrong word, but I am fascinated by it, because then and now I think of crowd psychology as a very interesting, this idea that like, you know, you think of yourself as an individual, and like I myself prize, you know, my individual thought, my ability to reason and make decisions on my own. but that there's this kind of mass amnesia or mass hypnosis point of inflection where all that stops, mm-hmm. and or fades, or it, you know, you lose your sense. And like, I'm sure that there's some evolutionary advantage to doing, yeah. so safety, why, numbers and all that, right?
Yeah. Why suddenly we all become starlings and go in flocks, and it's right. very strange,
right. you know. But it's and like that there's, but it's just it really that fascinates me, because I think the loss of my own individual thought is scary to me, and I'm fascinated by that, you know, just like, you know, Alzheimer's and dementia,
yeah.
fascinates and scares me.
Absolutely.
Crowd psychology fascinates and scares me. You know, and I think that that's something, and not to mention that, like, you know, I don't care about sports one iota,
yeah.
At all, really. Yeah. But you know, that I was like, well, this in many ways, like the sports are in this book are besides the point almost entirely.
Yeah.
It's just like, it's just an excuse for, tribalism.
There you go. Like I was about to say that, like, I have a hard time reading this book in particular, not necessarily because of the violence, but because, like, I literally can't fathom a time where I would be in a large crowd situation where there are factions. Because one thing that I didn't really realize I did until I read this book is that, like, I can't think of anything that I love so much that there's a diametric other. You know what I mean? Where there's something like in competition, or, you know, I can't think of, like, aside from like the socioeconomic, like manifestations of like race and gender and things like that, I can't think of anybody who I would be like an other of. Like, my family likes the Mets, you know what I mean? But like, think of anything sure. where I would be someone's yeah. polar opposite. And it seems so intrinsically part of, frankly, like British and the subset, you know, cultures that the empire spawned, of like needing this enemy opposite, that I was really unprepared that it would trickle down to something as, frankly, dumb as sports. Like,
sure. I mean, I think Jerry Seinfeld had a good joke about like supporting a sports team, which is like, because the players are traded so often, that like really what you are a fan of is uniforms.
Yeah.
Laundry, I think it's like, it just comes down to laundry, yeah. you know, which I think is really funny, because it's like, yeah, I mean, what is the team? Like, what is that boat? That, like, you know, it's that thought experiment that if you replace the boat, you know, board by board over time, is it the same boat?
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
I do vaguely, but I don't know, like...
There's some, like, thought experiment where it's like, if you restore a boat over hundreds of years and you've replaced every, you know, piece yeah. of wood on it, is it the same boat anymore?
Yeah.
And I think about that with, like, sports teams, right? Where it's like, if you've replaced every single person on that team...
Which you have to do in athletics, because
yeah, people all the time
get old and can't do this anymore.
Yeah. And by old, you mean like 30.
Exactly. Exactly.
Right. So yeah, there's constant turnover and stuff like that. And it's just like, what are you really supporting, you know, at this point?
Location. It has to be like, and that just gets to this ridiculous root of,
yeah.
England's the size of like New York State, if not even smaller. Like, how
yeah, I know.
Can you be this violently angry towards someone who's from the next town over? You're not any different. You all drink out of the same river. What is the matter with you? And it's an intellectual frustration that I have, because I do understand the base emotions behind it and the base reaction to needing this sort of, definition of yourself.
Yeah, and I think tribalism is a hard thing to shake, you know, in human history, because it's what's kept us safe on the evolutionary, you know. You know, we're not meant to conceive of anything beyond our direct community. You know, our brains can conceive of them intellectually, but it's not the same thing as the people you see every day. And, you know, I think that I mean, gosh, I think that in many ways, what's, you know, the English hooliganism and the factions and all that is like, some of it is distinctly English and some of it I think is fairly universal. Yeah. Like, I mean, I was talking with a Marine, actually.
Interesting.
A friend of ours, mm-hmm. who I'm not sure if I should say on air, is his brother-in-law is a Marine and he served over in Afghanistan.
Oh, yeah.
And so I met him recently because our friend's brother was having this bachelor party in LA. And so we got to chatting and I was a little concerned. I'm like, I don't know if I have anything in common with this guy. He ended up being, he's really lovely in many ways. But I basically was like, you know, I want to broach the subject. You know,
yeah.
How do you feel about the fall of Kabul, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, he said that, like, because he had been there from, I'm going to get this completely wrong, but I think he was there early in the conflict or midway through the conflict. Mm-hmm. And then he had like a tour in the middle, like 2010 or something.
Oh, wow.
And that's not exactly right. But he did say that, like, in the beginning, he was like, it felt like that there was a dedicated mission. And by around the middle, that mission was really uncertain.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, he basically said that, like, you know, that, you know, if the people in this country do not think of themselves, they do not have a national, they do not hold a national identity.
Mm-hmm.
They hold tribal identities based on where they are because of, you know, the yeah. geography of where they live, right?
Yeah.
And so, like, it's impossible to have people attempt to defend the idea of a country if most of the people don't believe in the country that where they right. live.
Yeah.
And I think there is this kind of, like, you know, sense of tribal identity that is, you know, pervades somewhat universally. Like, I mean, you're from Connecticut. Like, mm-hmm. half of the state are Red Sox fans and half of the state are Yankee fans.
Yeah, basically.
Like, you can yeah. divide Connecticut.
Exactly.
Kind of, right?
Like, slash down from yeah, the exactly. Northwest corner down to the southeastern corner.
Right. And like, depending on go. What part of the state you live in, like, yeah. that's your allegiance.
You're fucked,
right?
If you're from Middletown, because you're in the middle and you might go either way.
Is there a town in Connecticut called Middletown?
Yes, there is.
In the middle of yeah. Connecticut? Mm-hmm.
There's like four okay. that start actually with middle and they're all in the same geographical area. Yeah.
Wow.
The Yankees, nice, they nice were not. The, yeah. No. The original settlers of Connecticut were not creative when it came to place names. I can tell you that much.
But, you know, regardless. Like, I think that the sort of English hooliganism is like in a, is so much more extreme than like the rivalry between
oh absolutely
Red Sox and Yankees, but you do see a bit of that
in New England culture. Absolutely.
Well, yeah, not yeah, right, exactly, right. So
no, it's very clear to me while reading this how America, and especially Eastern Seaboard America, is so still perfectly in step with British culture, mm-hmm. in a way that I am constantly uncomfortable with, mm-hmm. as someone who wants to separate America from Britain because America's got its own list of sins. But it is astounding how lockstep we still are with people that we fought a fucking war to not be a part of anymore. Like
right.
The tradition of, you know, drawing these completely arbitrary borders and defining yourself by these absolutely ridiculous arbitrary borders. And also just this inherent nature of needing an adversary that I think is just love. Like, it's so part of Britain. And Buford discusses it a few times, or usually in passing, of just kind of going like, this is what's left over from empire, of just kind mm-hmm. of like this need to always be in a fight to define, you know, and expand into territory and show other people how they're wrong and that you're better and things like that. And it's just such an intrinsic part of the empirical mindset mm-hmm. of needing to beat someone at all times. It's like, we still have that real bad. We can't get rid of it.
Yeah. It does feel like, yeah, that is. It's so funny that, like, to think of England as both as like this, like, or just English culture as being like this respectable, you know, stiff upper lip, like,
yeah,
like very, you know, very small show of emotion, but also we're going to dominate the planet.
Yeah.
It's such a strange, like, yeah. It's like, we are going to dominate you with dignity.
Yeah, you know, like, yeah, yeah. And you know, and so much of it goes back to this English idea of savagery that I think that mm-hmm. we don't discuss enough, of just like, they do want to make, as a friend of mine put it when she was on the show, she's from India, and she was discussing about how the part of the colonization of India was wanting to make millions of little brown Englishmen. And it was just like this desire to make other places that stiff upper lip, lack of emotion, lack of conflict, of rank and file, understanding what the rules are, understanding mm-hmm. what the manners are. That's just part of English colonialism, wanting to acquire the nice things and quelling the people who own them currently.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and you could make the argument that that kind of cultural aspiration reached us, you know, with the those Native American schools where people were separated Absolutely. From their families and, you know, educated in the proper, and you can't
yeah, podcast, air quotes,
but proper. I'm using air quotes, proper way, you know, that, you know, that's very, it's a very similar kind of mindset, the kind of a very narrow definition of what civilization is, you know?
Yeah. There's this part in the very, very beginning of the book that I highlighted that I really wanted to, like, it goes hand in hand with this mm-hmm. and I'm trying to find it because I screenshotted it. And he basically says part of this being, you know, English working class mm-hmm. is that no one else can talk about the working class.
That's right, right.
And it's this really fascinating thing that, again, one of the things that confuses me the most about I think the key definition or the difference between America's white fucked upness and the British white fucked upness is that for some reason, all Americans, and this really goes back to George W. Bush, and like, or at least in my mind, that mm-hmm. even the wealthiest, most privileged, most ridiculous American born with a silver spoon in their mouth, they want to be seen as working class. Like George W. Bush used to go to his ranch and cut down trees.
Yeah,
and
it's a badge of honor.
Exactly. Right. And mm-hmm. mispronounce veteran because for some reason they think it sounds better with only two syllables. And it's like this ridiculous thing that Americans all want to be working class. And the best way to prove that you are like should be in charge of everything is to show that you are from the lowest, you know, rungs of our society. And that does not exist in British culture. British culture is like, why the fuck would I want to be a plumber?
Yeah. You know, honestly, I was talking with Tara about this recently, about this kind of like, because we were talking about billionaires these days, like in jeans, you know?
Yeah. It pisses me off.
Because like in the early, you know, early 20th century, in the Gilded era even, like, you know, they made as much attempt to separate themselves from the lower classes mm-hmm. as possible. In the English tradition, you know, I would say. And now it's like they want to disguise their wealth, you know. It's like, at least be honest about how audacious you are.
How can everybody who's listening keep in touch with you and your work, Jonathan?
Well, gosh, I mean, I have a website, johnokino.com. And that is also, I believe, Johnokino, I believe, is also my Instagram handle. I think, what do I have to share these days?
Are you still doing house calls or are those on?
Those, I finished doing the house call series in April, partly because it seemed like we had turned a corner with vaccines, mm-hmm. how foolish I was. But also because I think I was just tired of doing
them.
I did 75 of
them. Oh, wow. That's so many.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
And, at a certain point, I think I just got tired of, you know, hauling the tripod and stuff.
No, I get it. Yeah.
And such. So the very last two are of Tara and then myself, just to kind of like finish it up. I think, you know, it could have maybe some life at some point, but it's not something that I'm eager to revisit. It was mostly an exercise in being able to continue to make films during a pandemic where I couldn't see people and visit friends whom I missed. But you can watch the entire thing actually on my website, johnokino.com, or on my Instagram account. If you're curious how people live their life during the first year or so of the pandemic.
I think you got some really, really, really beautiful, lovely discussions with people. And for the fact that they were very short films, it really meant a lot to me to watch them, and how many different kinds of people and how many different people you got to discuss during, you know, just general feelings. And most of it was very positive and very lovely and very life affirming in a very, very dark time. So I thought it was a beautiful series. And if you'd like to hear the remaining hour of this discussion, feel free to follow us on Patreon at patreon.com/fuckboysoflit. That's B-O-I-S, where just $1 a month will unlock this episode, as well as dozens of other full-length episodes about books you know and love. If you can't spare the buck, no worries, we more than understand. Just spread the word about FBOL on whatever social media platform is your favorite, or review us wherever you listen, especially if it's the good old Apple iTunes. I'm Emily Edwards, and have a good one.